Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have John Papa. John is a dedicated father and husband, a principal developer advocate with Microsoft, and an alum of the Google Developer Expert Microsoft RD and MVP programs. His passions are deploying and teaching modern web technologies and enjoying everything Disney with his family. John is co-host of the popular Adventures in Angular podcast, author of the Angular Style Guide, and many popular Pluralsight courses. He's also one of the kindest, nicest, and brightest people you're going to meet in the industry. John, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and I'm really happy to have you back because there is a lot for us to talk about. I want to divide today into two sections, if I may. One is technical, and the other is more about presentation. You wrote to me that you think that presentation styles are changing. Can we start there and find out what you mean by that before we dive into the technical?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I actually put a poll out the other day on Twitter, which is completely, in some ways, it's like, wow, there's a poll. In other ways, like, you know, it's a very small subset of everybody. But I was asking folks, you know, what do you enjoy attending at a conference? What kind of length is the perfect session length, not including workshops and other things? And I chose my words carefully because I wanted to see what people enjoy attending. And a lot of people replied, and it wasn't a poll. I just asked for a thread to be created. And a lot of people replied from the perspective of a speaker, which I found interesting. You know, as a speaker and as an attendee, I think they're not exactly the same. Like putting together a talk, Jesse, when you go speak, do you enjoy putting together a 5-minute talk or an hour long talk or a 3-hour long talk? I mean, aren't there differences in how you approach that?
Absolutely. 5-minute talk is probably the hardest. There's a famous quote about, I would have made this letter shorter, but I didn't have enough time.
Yeah, exactly. And it really does take more time. I've done those. I've done 30-second talks. I've done 5-minute talks. And I put more effort into those than I do into the 20 or the half hour or the hour. It gets progressively easier the more time you have. And a lot of the reason for that is when you have time, you don't worry about it. And put it in perspective. Think about if you've ever worked at a large company or any size company, and your vice president, president, some CXO calls you in and wants you to talk. Those people generally have a very limited attention span for you. They want you to get right to the point, tell them what you want, tell them what you want them to do and what the value is going to be, and then answer questions very quickly. You can't sit there for an hour and go, well, you know, I am so-and-so and I was born in Tennessee and I used to enjoy doing .NET and now I do Node, and it just doesn't work in that situation. It's the same thing with shorter talks. So getting back to your original question, I think what's happening a lot in this poll I saw was people generally responded that if they want to learn something, they want more time. Like if they want hands-on labs or depth, they want an hour or a day. And some people responded multiple days. If they just want to go to an event, a conference, and they want to understand the biggest question, which is most people ask us this, I'm sure you've heard it, Jesse, is how do you know what to focus on and what not to focus on with all this new technology that's out there?
Yes.
And a lot of people come to these conferences now, and it's seeing this in the threads that I've been creating. They just want to know, how do I know of the 100 things out there? If I go to an event, if you can tell me in a couple of minutes, you know, which things I shouldn't look at and which things I should, and not just you should look at this or that, but give me, you know, a couple of minutes of each thing just so I can know, okay, that's what that is. I don't really need to focus on that because I don't do that. Or, ooh, that sounds really interesting. I could really take advantage of that. So then later I can dive deeper at my own pace.
The one thing I would add to that is tell me what it is briefly, but also tell me why it's valuable or why I should care.
Yeah. We tend to focus too much in the past on how. This is my opinion. I feel like it's speaking and being an instructor for as many years as we have, a lot of us came from the teaching perspective, which is great. I mean, I used to teach 40-hour classes a week, and I still do occasionally. But those things are very different than going to a conference. Conference, nobody's going to sit there and listen to you for 40 hours and learn everything there is to know about, let's say, Angular, ASP.NET, Node, whatever. Not unless they pay for that kind of thing and, you know, you've got a full week to dedicate. But most of the time, these hour-long talks, or some of them are hour and 15, hour and a half that we've been to, I feel like they could really be trimmed down to 20 minutes, 30 minutes if you cut out all the fluff and really just focus on what are we here to talk about? Why is it valuable? Is it really for you? Because not every technology is for everybody, right? And here's how you kind of get started with it and what you could possibly accomplish if you do this.
It would be fascinating to see a conference where at least one track was a series of 20-minute talks instead of a series of one-hour talks. I wonder if that would be popular.
Yeah, there's challenges to that logistically, because I've been asked that. If, hey, about you do one track that way and one with hours. The one way I've seen that work is, let's say you have hour time slots for most talks, and then you do 20-minute time slots in another track. As long as they add up to the same thing, that kind of works. It's when they start overlapping too much, or it gets hard for people to pick and choose between the different tracks, it becomes difficult.
No, I think your insight is good, and I think we should pursue that in terms of rethinking the way that we do presentations. But I want to turn your attention, if you don't mind, to some more technical things that you've been working on. Let's talk a little bit about Angular. I've been immersed in Angular 4, but I sort of skipped. I mean, I did some work in Angular 2 and then sort of skipped over that and dove into Angular 4. And I'm not sure I really understand what the differences are. Can you lay that out a little bit?
Between Angular 2 and version 4?
That's right.
Very little, actually. So the great thing about what Angular is doing right now, and you know, no matter what anybody does in this industry, I think we all have entitlement syndrome. No matter what somebody does, it's the wrong thing, right? So what Angular is doing is being extremely open with everybody and saying, look, Angular 2 is out there. We had basically the same version of Angular 1 with minor releases, Angular 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, etc., for like 5 years. We really want to follow Semver, and we're hearing from enterprises that they want to know when things are going to break and when things aren't going to break, so they know how to use version strategies. So they followed Semver, which basically means you get those three numbers, like maybe it's 4.3.0. The first number is a major. It means that we will not increment the major version unless there is a breaking change. The second number is the minor, and the minor, like the 4.3, that's the 3. That number won't change unless we have new functionality in some way. But it's not a breaking change. And then the third one is a patch. And the patches are just, you know, maybe there's a tiny bug they fixed or some documentation they fixed or just little tweaks that do not affect your code. And so that's the strategy Semver tries to follow. And there's more detail than that, but that's the overall gist. The reason this is important is so when companies are adopting Angular, and maybe you've got 100 projects running it, you know comfortably that, hey, there's a new patch out. Can we adopt it? Well, let's try it and run a regression test. If it works, there should be no problems. If it's a new major version, you should think twice and go read the changelog to see what happened. So getting back to your question, Angular 2 to 4, they made a major change release. They're going to do this every 6 months on a schedule. And the biggest changes they made from 2 to 4 were actually, they took me 5 minutes to fix. That's how minor those changes were. So they're going to do it on a fast cadence. To me, 6 months is fast. But they're doing this so they can adopt new things quickly. A lot of the stuff went from 2 to 4 actually was based upon some TypeScript changes that made things better and faster and easier. And most people will never even see the changes that they saw. And actually, Angular 5, version 5 is going to come out. I believe they're slated for this fall, maybe October. So maybe by the time this airs. So Angular 5 will be out and there'll be some minor changes there. I think the biggest one in Angular 5 is they're going to deprecate the HTTP module, I'm hearing.
Oh, really?
And they're going to, because they have a new one called HTTP client, which is better, faster, stronger. It's actually super easy to upgrade. I upgraded about 7 projects in about a half hour the other day. So little things like that are going to happen. I say little. It's not little if you got a lot of projects at your work because you have to upgrade those. But it also gives you an option to not upgrade if you don't want to, because they're adopting a support strategy too. So you don't have to move to the latest version. They will still support these other versions for a certain period of time. And all that details are up on their website for like length if you're caring to show your bosses at your work.
Let me ask you about the learning curve. I refer often to what I call the John Papa design learning curve, which is a long time ago you said about Angular that there was a steep beginning curve and then it sort of flattens out and it's not so hard to learn and then it gets steep again. That was back in the Angular JS days. Does that still apply to Angular, or what's it look like for learning now?
I don't know if I said that, but then again, I can't remember what I did for breakfast this morning. So I'll believe you on that. So Angular, the new version, there is more to learn. And the problem with Angular is, in my opinion, and there is a problem, it's the same problem we have with modern JavaScript. Angular is actually pretty easy. The hard parts are getting to Angular. So modern JavaScript has become this thing where we want to have optimized code, and we actually compile the code now, which we didn't used to do in years gone by. And all these things we have to do to get ready to use Angular or React or other major libraries these days, we're looking at using stuff like Webpack or System.js, TypeScript. There's things kind of in front of us, build systems. That's the hard part, because if you're not using one of those, you have to kind of get your arms around it first. But Angular itself, I actually find quite easy. And to get around this problem, both Angular and React have created CLIs, command line tools, which allow you to basically, they'll set up all that stuff around the edges for you and then just let you get right to Angular or React.
The Angular CLI, I haven't played with React. The Angular CLI is magic. It cuts out at least an hour, if not half a day, of setup.
Yes.
And then the ability to generate components and have all of the bookkeeping done for you, having it added to the module, creating the HTML, the CSS. I mean, that's just beautiful stuff.
Yeah, it's great. And that's the first thing people see is the two things you just mentioned. It's the get me the setup, you know, get me the right NPM dependencies, get me the right build processes and stuff in place, and generate my components. But the real magic is when you go to deploy it, which hopefully we all do someday, it actually makes deploying it so much easier and consistent, which can be a real pain if you have never done it before, if you ever use something like Gulp, Grunt, or any of those tools.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. You go to deploy and it creates a folder for you and you just put that up. And with Now, which allows you to deploy with one command.
Yep.
It's an astoundingly easy process.
Yeah, Now is made by what? Zeit? Is that how you pronounce it?
I wouldn't even venture to guess. So you've mentioned React, and the way it is positioned, at least casually, is that React.js and Angular are alternatives. Do you see them as alternatives? And if so, how do you decide which one to go forward with?
It's really personal preference. I think the biggest lie in technology today is we all try to believe that there's one way to do everything and that we think we can actually convince ourselves of that. It's not the case. Angular and React are alternatives to each other. They're different styles, different ways. I've seen people say this is better than the other, etc. They really aren't. They're both amazing. They're both excellent. They speak to different styles of programming. The big difference I see is I like Angular because everything's there for me. I mean, when I get going, most of what I need is right there with the Angular framework. It's a platform. With React, you're pulling in other tools and features to kind of build on top of it. And it's not a lot of extra things, but it's a few extra.
Yes.
And then, you know, they're just different styles. That's all. But both of them are very great. So if you're looking for a job, those are the two leading ones that are out there these days, too.
Right. And React seems to be coming up very, very fast. So if you're a developer and you're trying to decide which one should I invest my time in based on A, where's the work going to be, and B, how long is it going to take me to get going? Do you have advice or you think it's six of one, half a dozen of the other?
I really do think it's six and one half dozen the other. React is climbing faster than Angular at this point, but it's also because there's only so many web developers in the world. And Angular already has over 1 million developers using it. Mm-hmm. So React was, when it started out a couple of years ago, it's been on a high ascension, kind of like Angular was a couple of years back, you know?
Yes.
I feel like those are the two big strong ones, but don't count out Vue. Vue is going to be a strong player too.
I know you created some snippets and some helper code for Visual Studio Code for programming in Angular. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So I put together a set of snippets for Angular. So you mentioned generating components and things with the CLI, which is very cool. Sometimes, quite frankly, I'm already in a component or I'm already in something and I want to use that and I want to extend it. So I created some snippets from VS Code for some popular things. And I'll be honest with you, sometimes I use the CLI to generate files. Other times I'm already in a file and I just want to extend something or do something new. And that's where I use snippets quite a bit. And because I've been asked by people, why do you even have these snippets? Because the CLI does some of this for you. And it does do some of it, but not all of it. For example, they came out with this HTTP interceptors recently. They used to have that in AngularJS, if you recall. It was a tool that allows you to basically inspect all HTTP traffic from the browser, either coming or going, and then adjust it. For example, inspect errors, 401s maybe, 404s, add headers to all your calls for security or for other reasons, do logging, whatever you want, basically. And they added that back in to this new HTTP client, but it's not like that's a special thing that they had in the CLI to create, and they might do this. We're kind of talking to the team, but for now, I created some snippets that just help you create different kinds of interceptors. So that's what I like about the CLI and then complementing that with snippets. The CLI lets you like set up all your scaffolding, but the snippets kind of fill in those little gaps along the way.
When I think of snippets, I think of banding for convenience. So I can type PROP tab and it sets up the property for me and I can just fill in the pieces. But it sounds like your snippets go beyond that.
Yes, I try to avoid the ones that just add a little bit like that. I try to get things to do more. So I'll share a link and we can put it in the show notes if you like.
Yes.
There's a link here where I've got some HTTP interceptors. If people try those, you'll see some pretty cool stuff that you can do. And even like just using, maybe you want to create an interceptor, and that interceptor snippet that I have will generate the things you need to import, the class that you need to create, the method that you need to implement, and then basically get set you up with like a little logging example for an interceptor by default. So it gives you all the basics so you can look at it and go, okay, I don't have to worry about syntax. This thing will help me with that. I try to do that as opposed to, like you're saying, we used to type PROP and it would generate the getter setter type stuff.
Right, right. No, you're my hero. Setting that kind of stuff up is tedious and error prone, and having snippets that do that for you is going to be great.
Yeah, and nobody likes to remember syntax. Well, I'm not going to say nobody, but I don't like to remember syntax.
Right, right. give me an idea of some of the other snippets that you have.
So there's a bunch in here. I've organized these by TypeScript and HTML and even some RxJS ones. One of my most common problems is when using RxJS, everything is in its own file, effectively. So if you want to use an operator in RxJS, you may not know where it is or the name of it or the syntax to import it, because it's a little different than just saying regular imports. So I have little snippets that say, okay, I want to go add the operator for catch because I'm going to do a catch statement. I got a snippet that'll create that import line of code for you and then put you at a prompt there for where you type the word catch. Because I always get the syntax wrong or the spelling or the order of the folders. Other things are like creating an async ng4 inside the HTML template. Sometimes I forget where to put the different symbols. Little things like that.
And the documentation for these snippets, are they at the same URL that we're going to put up for the snippets themselves?
Yeah, there's a list of what each snippet is and then what it does. There isn't, and I've got a little animated GIF that shows you one or two of them on the page. But the best way to do it is just to install it and then try it out inside of VS Code. The nice thing is the folks at WebStorm and some of the other tools like Sublime, there are people who have taken my snippets for VS Code and have adopted them for WebStorm, Atom, and Sublime as well.
Wow. But you do most of your work in VS Code.
I do all of my work in VS Code, yes. Love it.
Yeah, you've converted me. Big VS Code user, and one of the things I like about it is I'm a bit of a Mac guy, and I can do all that work on the Mac, and then if needed, I can move it over to Windows without a problem. I know that's true for a lot of the editors, but I find that very smooth with VS Code.
Yeah, yeah, you know, being on a Mac, it's really nice. I haven't touched Windows in about 6 years, so it's kind of nice to just stay away from it, and I can go do VS Code. But when I work with somebody who does use Windows, it's nice because I can go over there and work in that editor too.
Yes, absolutely. Allow me to switch topics on you. One of the really hot topics that I've been hearing a lot about is Cosmos DB. Are you working with that, and can you give me sort of an overview of what's exciting there?
Yeah, so let me preface this with, when I hear about new products, I'm pretty skeptical usually. I'm like, ooh, that's cool, but like, why would I want to use it? So I always look at everything as with that lens, because I don't really appreciate when I hear, oh, it's amazing, it's awesome, but I'm never actually going to use it. So what Cosmos is a product from Microsoft on the Azure services where it allows you to, this is my perspective, it allows you to work in any model database that you want and program with that API, but still use Cosmos. Now, what does that mean? It means if you're used to using Gremlin, which is a graph database, or MongoDB with a NoSQL database, if you're used to using those, you can actually take apps that you've written against those databases today and move them to Cosmos, and all you have to do is change the connection string. Cosmos, you just tell it what type of database it is and the connection string, it figures it out, and you can use all the same exact code you have now. The advantage of that is Cosmos is a multi-model, globally replicated, super fast database. So you can literally just spin up replicas all around the world, and you can tell your code to use the nearest one to you, or you know which one will be a backup. And the latency you get for these nearest ones are single millisecond digits.
That's astounding.
So super fast.
Yeah, that's astounding. Will it also support relational databases?
I don't see any plans for that right now on their website, so I can't say if they will or won't, but I know people keep asking me that.
Okay, but essentially it's for document-based or NoSQL-based databases.
Yeah, and there's a couple other types on there. They're escaping me. I'll go check out the site while we're talking, but it's pretty cool in that respect. Now, a lot of people, I mean, to me, this feels like it's made for those large enterprise scale, gotta be up all the time kind of databases. And they do have a free trial, which is nice as well. So there's a button you can try it out for free. Obviously, the more features you use, the more you're going to pay because, you know, if you create replicas in 20 countries around the world, they've got to do that for you.
Right. How tightly coupled is it to Azure?
It's an Azure service, so it runs on Azure.
Okay, that's pretty tightly coupled.
Yep.
But fair enough. What about adoption? Do you have any idea of how quickly that's being picked up?
Yeah, it's been growing quite a bit. I think they announced it in May of this year, 2017, and there's a site called DB Engines, I think, where they kind of track the popularity of databases, and it's been rising quite a bit. I can get a link to that, too, for the show notes.
Okay, great. While we're on Azure, I had a note here about deploying JavaScript node apps to Azure, and maybe before you talk about that, you could just describe briefly what a JavaScript node app is.
Sure. So a lot of apps these days they're a way where you can create a backend and a front end if we just oversimplify. Your front end is what you're going to put in the browser for your web apps, and your backend runs on a server somewhere. In the past, the most popular things for many years in enterprises were Java and .NET. These days, there's other options. Node is super popular, so is Go. That's another newer thing that's out. And there's things like PHP that have been around and Ruby, et cetera. But Node JavaScript apps, a lot of times these days I'm building my backend with Node with JavaScript to run all my services and spin up my servers. And then I use JavaScript in the client with Angular or just plain old vanilla JavaScript. And then deploying those to the cloud is really easy with the modern cloud technologies we have.
Okay, so that's JavaScript Node. And how does that relate to deploying to Azure?
So we can deploy just about anything to Azure, Python, Node, .NET, etc. But what's nice about using Node with Azure is you can literally just take your app that runs locally, and then you can deploy that directly to a Linux or a Windows server up in the Azure cloud, because you can run it on either platform. So you can take your code and just push it up there. You can do it through FTP. You can do it through a Docker container, or you can do it through like a CI system like Visual Studio Team Systems or Travis or whatever your favorite flavor is.
Great. I know we're a little bit all over the map with different topics, but one of the other very hot topics, and I've had John Galloway on talking about it, but I wanted to get your take on it, is Azure Functions, which strike me as one of the more interesting, perhaps more exciting aspects to come out of Azure in a while.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's based upon a technology that folks call serverless. So serverless is a great name because it makes you think there's no servers anywhere. And that's kind of the idea. They want you, they meaning all the cloud providers, they want you to feel like there are no servers and you don't have to worry about that. They'll take care of it for you. It's like, we got this. And serverless functions allow you to solve this problem. Jesse, have you ever started to create a backend web API where you needed to create CRUD methods for updating a customer, getting a customer, getting their orders, their details, saving those order details? You do that a lot?
Isn't that what programmers do?
Pretty much all the time, right? So we always have something in the back end we have to connect to. And it's more than just CRUD. Sometimes we have to connect to other systems and maybe go talk to one system with an Oracle back end on Java and the other one with SQL Server with .NET. Serverless functions help us solve the problem where, oh man, now I got to go create a back end service that kind of connects all these dots together and exposes these endpoints. All right, well, what platform am I going to use? And what server am I going to store this on? And when you put it on the server, you got to make sure you got the right version of the frameworks and the tools and you know what I'm saying? All that setup stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
So with serverless, you're still writing the functions that connect all these things together, but you don't have to worry about creating a server to put it there. You just write the code. You can do it right in the portal. Or what I do is I put it in the GitHub repo and push it to the portal, the Azure portal. You just write the functions out. It's, you know, your normal 10 lines of code you write in a function. It says, go get my customers, go save my customers. You handle it in either C# or JavaScript or Python or however, what language is your favorite. And you push it into the cloud. And that's it. It handles spinning up the functions when they're used. And it tears down when it's not in use, and you only pay for what you use.
Right, and my understanding of these is that to get them to actually run, there are a variety of ways that you can trigger each of these functions.
Yes, the most common one that I use is the HTTP type, because most of what I do is I have an app request something, and I want it to respond, which is over HTTP. But you can have event triggers and queue triggers and timer triggers, and there's all these kind of ways you can trigger the functions with different actions.